two topics today. So in the first lecture, we talked about different ways you might solve the quantum measurement problem. One of them was by rejecting the postulate that dynamics is unitary. That corresponds to what are called dynamical collapse theory. So we'll start with that. And then the second topic will be Everett's interpretation. So let me just remind you what the problem was, that if you start this kind of Stirn-Gerlach experiment off with the superposition of spin states and the apparatus ready, then you get this entangled state, and you find that the apparatus does not have definite properties, such as having measured up or down. And so we noticed that that implied a strict inconsistency between what you say about the dynamics of the system if you take the collapse postulate seriously. So you say it's indeterministic and discontinuous, and the system has determinate properties. Whereas if instead you model the apparatus as a collection of atoms and assign it a Hilbert space and apply unitary evolution to the composite of system apparatus, then you find that the evolutions are deterministic, continuous, and the system and apparatus don't have determinate properties. So the strategy of collapse theories is to say that unitary dynamics is wrong, and in fact, fundamental evolution law is a non-unitary dynamical evolution law. And to resolve this inconsistency, you need to presume that the dynamics is either nonlinear or it's indeterministic or both. Because the if you remember the details of our derivation of on the previous slide, how we got that this is the final state, that presumed linearity and determinism. So there were some early works that tried to make nonlinear theories work, and none of them were particularly elegant. And then eventually, people set it on linear but indeterministic models that were a lot more elegant. And most of the work is on linear indeterministic models. So I'll be talking about those. But the basic idea is that this new fundamental evolution law has certain limits. So if you ask what does it imply for macroscopic systems, then to good approximation, it's a collapse postulate type of dynamics. And if you ask what does it mean for microscopic systems, then to good approximation, it looks unitary. So that's the goals of these sorts of things. So okay, that's where we are today on the second possibility, deny the universality of unitary dynamics. So here's the idea. What you want is at the end of the day, this new dynamics to predict that when this is the initial state and the apparatus is in the state of being ready to measure, then with probability a squared, it evolves to this quantum state. With probability b squared, it evolves to that quantum state. So there's a couple of issues. The first question is, I mean, you don't want to say this by fiat. You want it to come out of it your evolution law. So there has to be something about, I should be able to just analyze this as another physical state of some physical system, some collection of atoms, such that I get this. And so the question is, what is the decomposition of this state into a superposition of states relative to which the collapses occur? Can I specify the basis into which collapses occur in a way that only refers to the fundamental systems? That's the first problem. And just to show you, why it's a problem, let me note, so I'm going to slightly change notation here just for convenience. So plus and minus will be what I use to denote up and down. And these different O states are just going to be the states of the apparatus. So O0 is the ready state, O plus is the up state, O minus is the down state. So this is what we were looking at before, that in the quantum measurement problem, we get this state. But you can notice that it's possible to just rewrite this state in a different way. So if I define some new states of the apparatus, which are the positive and negative sums of O plus and O minus, and I define these states, you can verify that if you take these products, the cross terms will cancel and you'll get equality with this guy. So you could imagine, I can rewrite the final state this way. It's a perfectly fine way of writing it. These guys are still orthogonal, so it's still the case, for example, that these two terms are orthogonal terms in the decomposition. And the question is, well, why don't I presume, for example, that collapses occur in this basis? Like, so why don't I get this with some probability and this with probability? some probability. So a collapse theory has to specify a rule for the basis in which collapses occur. And one of the challenges is to get it to occur in the right basis so that it accords with what we see, so that you don't have collapses into these sorts of exotic bases. So the basic way that the collapse theories that have been proposed to date solve this problem is by postulating, as a kind of fundamental postulate of the theory, that these collapses are occurring, roughly speaking, in a position basis. So not strictly position, but it's a kind of a localization type collapse process. So it roughly localizes particles, and that tends to be sufficient to get the kinds of bases we want. So the idea is that the sorts of states that we see at the ends of experiments are things that tend to not be superposed across great distances. That's the idea. So the answer here is just by fiat, by postulate, they're going to choose a collapse mechanism that tends to localize in space. And then the second question is, by what mechanism do these collapses occur? Can I analyze that process more deeply somehow? And for the theories I'm going to tell you about today, this is really just postulated again as a sort of new primitive physical mechanism. It's just part of the fundamental dynamical law that these collapses occur. There are other ideas out there. So for example, Penrose is famous for suggesting that maybe the mechanism that leads to collapse has something to do with gravity and how much gravitational potential a given term in the wave function has. But those are really kind of speculations, and there isn't a well-formed theory around that. So all the sort of theories that are on the table as viable candidates for the interpretation of quantum theory, ultimately it boils down to assuming that this is just a novel kind of dynamics. Okay, so let's look. I'm only going to tell you about one example of this sort of theory, which is called the Girardi-Rimini-Weber model. It's from 1986. And this slide basically summarizes the whole model. So let me take you through it. So the idea is that the quantum state represents the state completely, and it evolves in the usual way, according to the Schrodinger equation, most of the time. But every once in a while, so every tau over, so n here is the number of particles. So every tau over n time interval on average, it evolves this way. So the new state is given by the old state multiplied by the square root of this particular positive operator ek. So here the index k is referring to, it's the particle index. So I'm imagining we have capital N particles here. And the kth particle in this instance is the one that suffers the collapse. So the idea is that you choose a particular particle uniformly at random, and it gets collapsed in this way. This EK operator is something that is diagonal in the position basis. So these are eigenstates of the position operators, so for all three spatial dimensions of particle K. And this is just a Gaussian centered at some position, or some position vector, QK, with some width sigma squared. Okay, so this is just basically describing a process by which the quantum state of this many-body system is suffering a collapse on the kth particle. So the kth particle is being localized, and the position to which it's localized is chosen by sampling it uniformly at random from the distribution over QK that is defined by the original state, psi. Right? So just take the reduced density operator for particle K and psi, calculate psi squared. That'll give you a probability distribution, sample Q from that, and then you localize to that position. The width sigma here is just a fundamental parameter in this model. Okay, and so it's presumed to be about 10 to the minus 7 meters. Okay, so it localizes it to a tenth of a micron. And this tau parameter, which tells you how frequently a given particle collapses, is again just a fundamental parameter of this model, and it's taken to be 10 to the 15 seconds, which is about 100 million years. So every particle in the universe, according to this model, every 100 million years or so at random collapses to a region on the order of a tenth of a micron. That's the idea. So if in my lab I have a single particle passing through an interferometer, and the whole experiment lasts, you know, a fraction of a second, it's very unlikely that you're going to see a collapse, because it only happens once every 100 million years. But if I have a large number of particles, then it's quite likely that one of those particles is going to collapse. Okay, so let me say, I don't know, let me just pause. Did I say everything that needs to be said on this slide? Is this clear? Any questions? Yes?
What's a large K?
A large K. Ah, thank you. So this is just a factor to make sure that when I sum or I integrate over QK, I get a POVM. So this is you can think of this as a POVM. So when I integrate over QK, I should get the identity operator. So this factor here is just a normalization factor on the Gaussian to make sure that that happens. Yeah. And that brings me to the point I wanted to make next, is that you can think of, you know, the mathematical form of this collapse operation is exactly the same mathematical form as if I had done a POVM measurement of approximate position and asked what's the state update rule for that measurement. That's, so in Joseph's course, you would have seen, you know, examples of the analog of the von Neumann-Luders update rule for POVM measurements rather than projective measurements. This is one of the standard ones. You just take the positive operator, take its square root, act on either side of the density operator. So so one of the reason these collapse models end up being sort of mathematically nice is because they are using part of the formalism that we now, you know, use all the time in quantum information theory of these generalized measurements. So when this stuff was invented, it wasn't so clear what that connection was, that these could be thought of as generalized measurements, but now it's pretty clear that this is how you can think about it if you want. Okay. So let's see what this looks like for just a single particle in one dimension. Just a simple example. So suppose I have a wave function of a single particle, so x is just the coordinate of the particle, and it's a sum of two terms. So phi a is this wave packet, phi b is this wave packet. They have certain relative weights, that it's normalized. So the theory says that, you know, every 100 million years, this thing's going to collapse, and so I'm going to sample a position q at random from the mod squared of this distribution. So suppose I get q to happen to be here. That's, you know, close to the peak, so it's sort of one of the likely q's that you get. Then it says, okay, write down the Gaussian, which has width sigma and centered at q. Multiply that original wave function by the Gaussian and draw the new wave function, right? So this is the final wave function of the particle after the collapse occurs. So it's made the transition from this to something like this. And I haven't, you know, this thing is very small out here, but of course there's still like a little wiggle down in the very small regions here. And now the particle continues to evolve according to the Schrodinger equation with that new wave function. That's the idea. It gets more interesting when we talk about composite systems. So if I have two particles, for example, so here's a wave function for a pair of particles. So x1 is the position of the first, x2 is the position of the second. Phi A and phi B, like before, are wave functions centered here and here in x1. And chi A and chi B are similarly going to be two wave functions that are peaked low and high along the x2 axis. So this is an entangled state where the positions of the two particles are entangled. If one of those particles gets collapsed, right? So for example, suppose it's particle x2, the second particle that suffers a collapse. So q2 is going to be drawn at random from whatever the psi squared distribution for particle 2 is, which you can calculate. I've chosen a q2 that's near the maximum of that distribution. And I multiply the Gaussian for q2 on this wave function. But of course, x1 is not collapsing, so that I can just take the uniform function over x1, multiply by that. Nothing's happening to the wave function along x1. But the point is that if you look at what happens when I multiply this function by a Gaussian that only has significant overlap with chi A and basically zero overlap with chi B, is that it kills the whole second term. So even though you know, particle x1 is not collapsing, you know, the whole second term is basically going to zero. And so it essentially means that this thing becomes localized not only in the x2 degree of freedom, but in that x1 degree of freedom as well, because it's basically going to end up in just the first term. So it's not quite equal to just the first term. Well, that the chi a thing is changing, right? Because whatever the profile was down here, it's now being multiplied by this narrow Gaussian. So that's changing. But I'm and furthermore, there may be a little bit of an extra term here, because this product of this Gaussian with this term wasn't exactly zero. But it's essentially something like this. So this is the key thing, that for entangled states, if just one of the particles gets collapsed, it essentially induces a collapse on the other particles as well. That's just what I have here. Good, so the wave function becomes localized in both coordinates, even though only one of the particles is hit. So now we can reanalyze the situation for the quantum measurement problem. I'm again going to use this slightly different notation of plus minus O plus O minus. And here's the point that, you know, the states of the apparatus, that's really a Hilbert space of a very large number of particles, right? Like if I have some, you know, pointer sitting or some screen sitting in my lab, that's a very large system. So there's a very large number of particles sitting in there. And typically, for example, if the experiment concludes with the pointer, you know, going left or right, so just for illustrative purposes, I'm going to say, let's just imagine the physical system, which is the pointer. You know, in one branch of the wave function is pointing this way, and the other branch of the wave function is pointing this way. So for all the particles in that pointer, so if I take the kth particle, the branch of the wave function where it's pointing left and the branch of the wave function where it's pointing right, I mean, those wave packets don't really overlap at all. Right? They have very small overlap, because one's localized way over here, one's localized way over here. So for a huge number of the components, k, of that apparatus, I'm going to have this product being close to zero. good. So that means that if any one of the particles in the pointer gets localized, then because I have this entangled state, you know, if just one of the particles gets localized, then it's going to make the whole other term go essentially to zero. But now I know there's a huge number of particles, so you know, if I I expect that the wave function is going to collapse to just one of those two terms. So if it happens, like if I look at the kth particle, then there's some probability that, you know, with probability a squared, it's going to collapse to being over here. With probability b squared, it's going to collapse to being over here. And then the whole wave function of all the particles is going to collapse to this or to this, where the overall state of the apparatus is pretty much what it was before, except that the kth particle is going to be a bit different, for example. Well, I mean, it might be more different than that if they're entangled. But that's the idea. That's what we wanted to see. And then if you ask, OK, well, how frequently is this going to occur? Let's imagine that there's 10 to the 20 particles in your apparatus. Well, every particle only collapses every 10 to the 15 seconds, which is, you know, not very frequently. But it only has to happen to one of them. And so you expect that every 10 microseconds, some particle is going to collapse. And therefore, the whole pointer is going to collapse. So the idea is that this is going to occur very rapidly because there's so many particles in the macroscopic apparatus. OK. Good. So after the collapse is over, of course, then we can say, oh, yes, the apparatus really does indicate up or down because it's an eigenstate of the appropriate observables, unlike the entangled state we had before. That's the basic idea. Questions about that? Yeah.
So what happens in between every microsecond? There's like a superposition?
That's right. So the idea in this model is that there's these strange, you know, bizarre states that we don't see, but they get killed off very quickly. And as long as this time scale is short enough, we'll never notice that, and so we're OK. That's the idea. If this time scale were much longer, then they might say, OK, that's a problem if these things were persisting for too long. Yes?
When you mean like, when this is, the key ingredient here is that you're picking a basis by which the collapse gets induced every time scale.
Mm-hmm.
Could that be any basis? Like you've chosen a position, but could it also be a momentum basis, for example?
That's a good question. Suppose that, you know, if I ask myself, okay, consider a particle that goes into a superposition of being here or here, depending on whether the point is left or right. And now suppose I were to localize that in the momentum basis. Would that succeed at collapsing this to one of the two terms? Probably not. If that momentum eigenstate has a high overlap with both a wave packet localized here and a wave packet localized here, then all it's going to do is sort of maybe slightly change the relative weights of these two terms, but it won't pick out one of those two options. Now, perhaps you could devise a special measurement apparatus that encoded its outcome, or perhaps you could devise an argument that said, actually, when measurements are completed, the outcomes do get encoded in outcome of some stuff and enough stuff. Like, so for example, the measurement's over, you know, the pointer eventually has to move one way or the other. That's going to deflect some of the air molecules in the room. So the momenta of the air molecules in the room is different depending on whether I got up or down. And maybe there's enough information encoded in the momentum basis of the environment such that, yeah, you've got a macroscopic number of things that are really distinguishable in momentum so that if I collapse on that basis, it's fine. I managed to get down to this or this. So it's conceivable, but roughly speaking, in most of these sorts of interpretations, people recognize that the position basis tends to play a special role, that things that we recognize, or I should say decoherence, most decoherence mechanisms, when I look at the Hamiltonian of the universe and I ask how do physical environments, what sorts of information do they carry away about systems of interest, it tends to be through a position-position type coupling, so it's usually position information that's carried away, so that's safe. If you choose your preferred basis to be a position basis, then you tend to find that it collapses into a bases that, you know, are the same kinds of bases that get measured by the environment and that persist over time. Other questions? Yes.
If you think of the whole universe as your system, does it just like stay collapsed? Like it never, like, it just keeps collapsing like basically the entire time, so it has no time to be like a quantum state.
Well, say the whole, let's model the whole universe as just n particles. So the idea, and, you know, perhaps n is 10 to the, I don't know what, but whatever it is, like if it were a universe of 10 to the 20 particles, then on average, every, for 10 microseconds, the universe would just be evolving according to Schrodinger's equation. If it were more particles, then the amount of time by which it just evolves according to Schrodinger's equation decreases. But it really only suffers, this collapse dynamics is like a hit. It's a suspension of Schrodinger momentarily, replaced by this new dynamics, and then it goes back to Schrodinger. So,
don't you run into like Zeno's paradox then? Keep measuring it, it changes.
But you're not measuring it continuously over and over again. The model says, you can think of it this way: for every particle in the universe, there's a stochastic process that decides when it's going to collapse. And that stochastic process, on average, has collapses occurring every 100 million years. So for this particle, you know, it gets its first collapse, and then 50 million years later, it gets collapsed again, and then 120 million years later, it collapses again, and so on, right? So it's stochastic. It doesn't have to be there, but it's a process. And that's true of every particle. So every particle is collapsing only once every 100 million years. And that means, you know, on average, there'll be periods of time where nobody's collapsing, right? So it's not as if every particle is collapsing all the time, it's just collapsing occasionally. Does that make it clear?
But if they're all entangled,
yes.
Like if you say you have an entangled state,
yes.
It's going to collapse like
pretty
soon.
Right, right. And so if at any point in the universe's history, a very large number of particles end up getting into one of these entangled states, which is what a kind of measurement does. Like if I make the position of a large object like a pointer depend on the microscopic properties of a single spin, I've come to generate one of these really big entangled states. And what this theory says is every time the universe does that, those entangled states don't last very long. You know, they collapse really quickly. But these guys will say, well, that's what we wanted, because it's exactly those large entangled states that are the interpretive problem. They're the ones that would suggest that big objects don't have well-defined properties. We don't see that. So this is exactly what we wanted. You won't find these kinds of macroscopic superpositions in the universe. However, if you look at all the experiments we've tend to do in the lab thus far, they don't involve verifying coherence of a very large number of systems. They involve one or two particles. Everything looks coherent. Nothing looks like it violates non-unitarity. And they say, we can salvage that fact as well. That's consistent with what we've got, because we would only expect those few particle systems to collapse once every, you know, few million years or tens of millions of years. And so we don't expect to see anything different from a theory where everything was evolving unitarily for those small systems. Yeah?
Can you go back a slide if possible?
Sure.
The entire slide. Mm-hmm. Maybe another one, sorry. Okay. The one where you first define all of the elements.
Yep.
There it is. So one thing I don't understand about the collapse part is there's this time scale set, this dt, right, between how the state changes before and after the collapse.
Yep.
But like, is that still instantaneous in some sense? Or is there just like some other time scale as well that for which the collapse happens in a dynamical way, but really
right.
quickly?
So in this theory, which was the first successful collapse model, it's really imagined to be an instantaneous mechanism. So it's discontinuous. It just happens instantaneously. But subsequent theories, so there's something called continuous spontaneous localization, where you have a real dynamical process. And so it's a bit, the way it often gets described is there's a game called Gambler's Rune, where two people are gambling, and they both start with a pot of money, and there's a random process that has, you know, one give a dollar to the other or back. And if you play for long enough, eventually somebody runs out of money, and then it's over because you can't transfer back. And so if you play this game, you'll find that the frequency with which player A wins and the frequency with which player B wins depends only on the ratio of their initial pot to the total amount of money, right? So if you play the game many times, it takes time before you collapse to, you know, one of the players having all the money, and it's a continuous process. And if you make the transactions arbitrarily small, you can think of it as a continuous process that ends up collapsing into one or the other. So the math of that proposal, continuous spontaneous localization, works like that. It says if I've got a wave function with two terms, there's this process that transfers amplitude between the two terms and eventually leaves all the amplitude in one term. So it replaces this kind of instantaneous hit mechanism with something a bit more physical. And it posits that there's now a random field which sort of determines which way each of these transfers go. But yeah, I'm not going to present that guy. All right, so what do you guys think about this interpretation? Like, any criticisms? I have a few that I want to mention, but I thought I would give you guys a chance to.
So
yeah.
This would mean like quantum computers would be kind of really, really hard to implement, given that the collapses are going to be random, and then your coherent states are going to collapse randomly without your control.
It is definitely a source of noise, which is problematic for quantum computation. However, if you look at the source of noise, it's mathematically, it is of the same form that you would have if your system coupled to an environment that was carrying away information. And that is already a challenge that quantum computers have to meet. So if you've got a fault-tolerant quantum computer, so you've got a scheme by which you redundantly encode your information and you look for errors and you correct for them, then it can handle errors due to this fundamental collapse mechanism just as easily as it could handle errors due to a collapse induced by coupling to the environment. So it doesn't mean that quantum computers are impossible. And in fact, I would say if what's important for this sorts of model is that the collapse mechanisms are not so frequent and so obvious that, you know, we would have seen them by now. Like that we need to have, they would like to see experiments that prove that there's anomalous decoherence. So that would be the experimental signature of this model being right, the proponent's claim, is if you see anomalous decoherence. You take a system, you isolate it, you think you understand all the environmental degrees of freedom it's possibly interacting with it, so you have a theoretical basis for saying, here's the rate at which this thing should decohere, and then you see some anomalously high degree of decoherence that's not accounted for that, but does coincide with one of these proposals. And you say, right, that means that the collapse theory was right. Okay, so other thoughts about criticisms? Where was it? What do people think? Is this, who's gonna become a collapse theorist from now on?
Like, were the tau and the sigma just kind of chosen?
Like, good question. Where do they come from?
They fit what you want them to be.
Yeah, it's a funny business. So I think, as far as I can tell, the honest answer to this question is they chose tau and sigma such that it really has to do with what would be tolerable in terms of human perception. Like, we do not see things going into funny states. And, you know, there's only so much time resolution we have. I can't tell if something funny is happening at the order of a nanosecond, but, you know, I can tell at the order of 100 microseconds, or actually I don't know exactly what the finest resolution we have is, but it was those sorts of considerations. And similarly with the length scale, is that we only have so much resolution, so we can tolerate a bit of vagueness at certain scales. And so they're meant to be human perceptible scales. So you actually, if you read some of these class papers, there's something very bizarre in my view, where they'll have like a parameter space, and usually you have sort of regions of parameter space that are sort of excluded by certain experiments. And in their plots, they have a region of parameter space that's sort of excluded on the grounds that this wouldn't solve the interpretational problems. Like if this time scale were too long or this length scale were too long, you know, we would see strange things, and so we know that can't have those values. All right, let me move on to some of the criticism. So the first criticism relates to a point we talked about earlier, which is just that if you look at the mathematics of these particular proposals, the anomalous decoherence that they posit has exactly the same mathematical form as what you could obtain by coupling your system, say this is your system, via unitary to some ancillary system, tracing out the ancillary system. So here, this is something you will have seen in Joseph's course, that any trace-preserving completely positive map can be modeled by a Steinspring dilation in this way, coupling unitarily to some environment. And so in particular, if I consider the case where I don't learn where it was collapsed or which particle was collapsed. So I'm integrating over position, summing over k. So this whole thing then becomes just some trace-preserving completely positive map. It just decoheres the particle, right? It's adding noise to the particle state. And so the Steinspring dilation theorem applies, and whatever happens, whatever that anomalous decoherence mechanism is, it could be modeled by just some other degree of freedom in the environment that you hadn't known about before, coupling to your system and carrying information away. So what this means is just that there's a sort of ambiguity. Even if we went to the lab and we saw anomalous decoherent, we couldn't conclusively say, we were wrong about the nature of the dynamics in quantum theory. We could instead say, no, we were wrong about the kinematics. We thought that there weren't other environmental degrees of freedom coupling to the system, and we were wrong about that, and this experiment shows that. So proponents of other interpretations of quantum mechanics can always respond to what these guys consider the smoking gun evidence and saying, no, I still favor my interpretation, and I interpret this as just evidence of some additional degrees of freedom heretofore not recognized, but I can incorporate them into my model and understand what's going on. So that's not necessarily a criticism of the interpretational strategy, but just a problem in the sense that the thing that's supposed to be the experimental signature for this dynamical collapse mechanism doesn't really rule decisively in its favor. You know, other interpretations can accommodate that evidence. All right. Secondly, there's something called the tails problem. And there the question is, well, how localized does something have to be for it to sort of appear well localized to us? Because, you know, these collapse mechanisms have, you know, it's a Gaussian, it has a long tail. So this second bump in the wave function has just been suppressed, but it hasn't gone away. So I don't really have a product state here. I really have an entangled state, just where the amplitude of the second term is very small. And so it's still not the case that I can say that the property of being, say, in this region here, is a determinate property of this particle. Because strictly speaking, I have that other term, it's not an eigenstate. So instead, I have to do something and say, well, it doesn't have, it's not truly localized, it's somehow only approximately localized. And so then there's a lot of questions about whether that's enough. Like, does that recover our experiences? Does it recover our classical notion of what's going on if everything's just somehow approximately localized rather than truly localized? Another feature that many people have noted and are uncomfortable with in collapse theories is that they violate energy conservation, which is typically taken to be a principle that you try to preserve in your physical theories. So the reason is that, if I take this example of collapse, the wave function has become, more peaked in this collapse mechanism. It always becomes more peaked. And so if you just, work out the kinetic energy of a particle, that depends on how localized it is. More localized wave functions have greater kinetic energy. And therefore, I increase the energy of the particle under these sorts of collapse mechanisms. If you calculate how much am I heating up the universe by virtue of this collapse mechanism, it's a very slow rate of heating. So it's not going to conflict with experimental data that we have today, or at least not that we know of. But it does mean that energy conservation is, strictly speaking, not preserved in this theory. And some people think that is an inelegant feature of the theory. Okay, and then finally, I just want to mention that we talked a bit about locality, we'll talk some more. If I collapse particle 2, like in this example here, then we noticed how particle 1, who started out, if I just look at the profile of particle 1's wave function, looks something like this. After the collapse on particle 2 has occurred, the wave function of particle 1 has changed. And because in this interpretation, the wave function is considered to be part of the description of reality, that means the reality at particle 1 has changed as a result of the collapse of particle 2, even if particle 1 is space-like separated from particle 2. So this model has action at a distance, as which we will see Bell's theorem predicts that any model that fits a certain framework is going to have that sort of action at a distance. And this one's no exception. But perhaps the bigger concern that people have is it's not clear if you can make a Lorentz invariant version of this model. So everything I've described to you is sort of a non-relativistic model where I imagine that sort of it happens instantaneously. There's some reference frame relative to which when this guy collapses, then immediately the wave function, the other one responds. And so I'm not an expert on the literature on how to try to achieve Lorentz covariant collapse models, but traditionally it's been a problem for these sorts of models. And actually, we'll see that this theme comes up a lot. A lot of these interpretations have problems with Lorentz invariants. I mean, it's once you see that you have the non-locality, you've already got a kind of in-spirit violation of relativity. So maybe it's not so surprising that it's difficult to make them Lorentz invariant. OK, so that's all I'm going to say about collapse models. Let's move on to Everett. Okay, so this is Hugh Everett III, who proposed this model in the 50s. He was supervised by John Wheeler at the time. It was his PhD thesis. So the approach to solving the quantum measurement problem here is quite different. As I mentioned before, the inconsistency is going to try to be resolved by saying it's really this that's going on, and this is just a subjective illusion. It's just an appearance to particular observers living in the universe. So we're on the last option here. Okay, so let's ask ourselves, remember that the collapse theorist in particular said, if this were to be the real state of affairs in the world, if the quantum state was a complete representation of reality, and we got into this quantum state, observers ought to see something strange. So the Everettian says, let's examine that claim. Let's ask ourselves, what would an observer see if this is the state that the apparatus went into? So what you can do is you can say, let's imagine that observers are also physical systems. Nothing special about them. They're collections of atoms. I can assign Hilbert spaces to an observer. The observer couples unitarily to other systems in the standard way. And so what that means is that, you know, whatever the initial state of the observer is, according to the representational completeness assumption, there is some quantum state that describes that observer, and I'll just call that the ready-to-observe state. Might be very complicated, but it has to exist. And the idea is that if the, just like previously I made this argument that if the apparatus is working properly, then whenever the spin is up, the apparatus should go to a state that indicates up. Similarly, if the observer is working properly as an observer, then whenever the apparatus goes to indicating up and the observer looks at the apparatus, the observer should go into a new state, which corresponds to seeing that the apparatus indicates up. Right? So I'm just assuming that this observer has competence. But if the apparatus indicates down, then the observer goes into this state. So when the observer, when the unitary is over, the observer gets absorbed into the entangled state, right? So there's a term in the entangled state where the observer is observing up, and there's a term where the observer is observing down. And so now the question becomes, well, what does it feel like to be an observer who's entangled with the rest of this stuff? Does it feel strange? Does it somehow feel like you're both observing up and observing down? So that's a tricky question, but you can start, you can make some arguments and say, well, no, it shouldn't feel strange. So here's one such argument. Suppose I ask about whether the observer has the property of thinking that the outcome is determinate. So I could define an observable which had as one eigenspace, you know, feeling like everything looks fine and determinate, and as this other eigenspace, somehow observing something strange happening, right? So by fiat, I'll say that, you know, if the observer were just in the state of observing up, nothing strange, right? That's going to be an eigenstate of the operator that I'm imagining corresponding to seeing determinate properties. And similarly, for this state alone, it'll also be an eigenstate of seeing determinate properties. But that means that if I ask about that observable on this whole state, well, it's also an eigenstate. Both of the terms correspond to the observer seeing something definite. So if you ask, does the observer have the feeling of seeing something definite, the answer comes back, yes. The observer feels that they're seeing something definite. And if I, for example, said, oh, let's induce another unitary interaction which gets the observer to report whether they're seeing something definite or something strange, what I'll find is that in both terms of the wave function, the reporter will say, yeah, everything looks definite to me, right? And so there'll just be another sort of change in the state of the observer where they say, yeah, it was up and it looked definite to me. So there's no term where the observer says there's something strange going on. So term by term, observers just report what we would expect them to report. Furthermore, if I look at multiple observers, and so here's a second observer, give them a state, all that happens to them is they get into the entangled state as well, and they agree with the first observer. So after the first observer measures, the second observer measures, and they'll always agree because they're competent observers. They see the state of the apparatus. So you have complete intersubjective agreement among all the observers. So you can't consult, your friend can't tell you, oh, you're radically deceived about what's going on because I got a different result. According to this model, everybody's going to see the same thing. So when they consult among themselves, they'll all agree that they're seeing determinate properties, and everything's fine. That's sort of the spirit of it, that term by term, everything looks normal. Now, let me go a bit further. This is a kind of a cumbersome notation, so I'm going to switch again to this O plus, O minus notation to make the equations a little bit simpler. And just like we saw in the collapse models, there's a kind of preferred basis problem here, too. So for this, we've been focused on this interaction, and the Everettian wants to say that each of the terms here corresponds to a subjective experience, that there's an observer in the world who's seeing the outcome up, and there's another observer seeing the outcome down. But then you notice that, well, I could have rewritten that state in this form. Why isn't it the case that we have two observers, one of which corresponds to this quantum state and one of which corresponds to this quantum state, and each of these are somehow different experiences? Like, I don't know what it would be like to have this sort of experience. So the question becomes, what picks out this as the basis relative to which you say that basis defines the set of subjective experiences that observers might have? So Adrian Kent wrote a paper criticizing Everett, and he insisted that Everett is lacking what he called a basis selection rule, some way of specifying what sorts of experiences observers will have. Good. So quick note that environmental interactions don't really solve this problem. So you might have said, well, what's going to pick out the basis corresponding to subjective experiences is the fact that it's the basis which, if I interacted with an environment, it becomes correlated in the entangled state. That doesn't really help, because I can rewrite this state here relative to that same funny basis for the observer. It's just that the relative states of the spin in the environment now become entangled. So I still have this question, what is it, what's special about the O plus O minus basis rather than this basis here? So what do you guys think? You see any ways of opportunities for saying what's special about the basis the Everettian needs to claim is associated with subjective experiences?
I think the preferred basis, I understand that there needs to be a specification of the preferred basis, but it could just be something that's also unsatisfactory, which is the question the observer asked, the measurement that they made, is the one that picked out the sort of definite experiences. And that sort of, that is another, you have to specify that that's the one which the observers sort of branch into.
Not sure I quite follow. Let me clarify something and tell me if you can clarify.
And in the plus minus basis.
Here we're modeling the whole interaction between the spin and the apparatus and the observer is just some fancy unitary, and it dictates that this is the evolution. And all I've done here is point out that very same unitary, whatever it is, which leads to some final state, that final state can be written in many forms. That's all I'm saying. Like, these are just two different forms of writing final quantum states. So this possibility, if I want to say, oh, I'm going to be an Everettian, but I'm going to interpret the branches of the universal wave function as this branch and this branch, rather than this branch and this branch, I'm not positing any difference in what's actually happened in terms of unitary interactions. So the question is really, for one and the same unitary interaction, why is it that this decomposition is somehow important for interpretational purposes, but this decomposition is not important? Doesn't the Everettian need to tell me which decomposition defines the branches in which there are well-defined subjective experiences? Is that?
Yeah, I guess what I was trying to say then was that the preferred basis is precisely the one in which you have well-defined subjective experiences.
Aha. Okay.
Always.
Good.
Maybe that doesn't work, but that's what it would have to be.
Yeah, so I think Adrian Kent would say something like, and which basis is that? You can define it as the one that has subjective experiences, but Adrian might say, well, so do these have subjective experiences? And if the answer is yes, he'd say, well, okay, so then, you know, does this theory predict that we have strange experiences? And if the answer is no, they don't, he might say, why? Why is it, how is it that you know that these guys don't have subjective experiences associated with them, but these guys do? Can you answer that question? Any other thoughts on what might be special? Might pick out this basis over this one.
Anything about the original basis you were in?
When you say the original basis, do you...
Well, I guess you kind of defined it.
You want me to go back a slide? Oops. Ah. So what are you referring to when you say the original basis?
Well, I guess it isn't really. I wasn't sure if you were kind of in the... your first...
Originally, the observer starts out in this O-not state, which is kind of ready to observe, which doesn't, as far as I can tell, sort of favor transitioning into O-plus and O-minus as two possibilities versus transitioning into this superposition or this superposition. I don't think the O-not state can resolve the ambiguity. All right, well, let me tell you about one idea that people have had, which is to do with the predictability of the evolution of the observer state. So suppose I bring in a second environment. Okay, so this has happened, and now I'm going to bring in a second environment. That's what the subscript 2 means. So if I think about how the O plus state couples to that second environment, well, generally, the way typical environments work is when an observer has, you know, just observed something, they're in some definite state, the environment tends to leave that state alone. Whereas if you're in a funny superposition state like this one, O plus plus O minus, you know, just like the pointer pointing left or pointing right, environment comes along and entangles with that. If you're an observer who's, you know, seeing up or seeing down, you're going into two very different kinds of internal states, and so environments are going to see those differences and become entangled with the O plus and the O minus state. Now, of course, I can rewrite that in terms of the positive and phase pi superpositions. And so now we can contrast the evolution here with the evolution here. So here, the O plus state transitions to O plus, whereas here, the positive superposition, its reduced density operator transitions to, with probability half the positive superposition and with probability half the negative superposition. So I could describe it this way, that there's a lot less predictability if I think of this basis of observer states. As they interact with the environment, they undergo this very unpredictable evolution, right? So if I asked at this time, are you in the positive or the negative superposition, it's random. So that's the distinction that people have pointed out, that the basis O plus O minus tends to be predictable, right? As I interact with the environment, it stays the same. Like a pointer that's pointing up, it can interact with this environment, it continues to point up. The environment tends not to generate a very unpredictable evolution. But if I have a pointer in a funny superposition of up and down, the environment entangles with it, and I can think of that as a very unpredictable evolution, right? If I came along and I measured in this basis again, I would find that perhaps it has transitioned. And then I let it evolve with the environment, I measure again, and it's just flipping back and forth between this state and this state. Highly unpredictable kind of evolution. So the claim here is that, well, there is something special about that original basis. It's the only one that seems to have this high degree of predictability under realistic interactions with the environment. Now, the proponents of Everett don't really take the bait on Adrian's criticism. They don't say it's our job to specify an extra component of our theory, which is a basis selection rule. Others, like Wojciech Zurek, have proposed things along those lines, a kind of way for selecting out a preferred basis that appeals to optimizing the predictability of that basis or something like that. But usually those sorts of proposals kind of go beyond Everett. They're more like hidden variable models. There's something extra to say about, you know, which term of the wave function you're in. The Everettians really want to say, no, there's no extra rule to be specified, but this phenomena nonetheless is important for the claim that we can really reproduce observations. So here's the idea. This is the response to the preferred basis problem that you'll read in the works of people like David Deutsch and David Wallace. I take it to be the kind of standard response of the proponents of Everett, which is that you don't need an axiom, a postulate, to pick out a basis selection rule, because real ontological things like macroscopic objects or worlds in the Everett interpretation are actually just emergent patterns. So you know, an example of an emergent pattern would be a tiger. So I think most of us would agree that tigers are real, but you won't find the concept of tiger represented in the axioms of the standard model. So the Everett wants to claim that the branches of the wave function are like that. I can talk about there being some reality associated with certain experiences without there being some fundamental axiom that says, here is the mathematical rule for what the branching structure of the universal wave function is. That's the claim. And so the point is that if you look at this basis that's picked out by decoherence, what we just talked about, the basis that's highly predictable even in the presence of environmental interactions, that's the basis that tends to have predictive power and explanatory power. So, you know, there are certain kinds of properties of objects that persist in the world. We usually call them classical-like properties. Those are the properties that are resilient to these interactions with the environment. So a pointer pointing up or pointing down is a kind of property that has resilience, it persists over time. The property of being in a positive or negative superposition of those two states has no persistence. It's not a very useful way of talking about the world, because if I say, oh, at this moment in time it had that property, that data becomes irrelevant a moment later because the environment just randomizes it. So the idea is that the patterns in the world that have this predictive and explanatory power are the ones that are useful to us. So they're the ones that we need to assign reality to. Right? That's the sort of criterion of reality. The emergent, the idea that, you know, I can associate reality with emergent pattern is that anything, any pattern that has explanatory and predictive power, that's kind of the key feature of a pattern for it to be considered a sort of real and important pattern. So they want to say that's how we should think about Everett, that that it's these predictive bases that are in the interesting emergent patterns, they're the real ones, and that's all we needed to recover. And incidentally, the fact that they're not defined entirely precisely doesn't detract from their reality. So you might have said, but hang on, this is all a little bit vague. I would have preferred an axiom that was very precise. And then the Everett will say, well, look, we all think that mountains are real, but you can't tell me exactly where the mountain ends and the valley begins. We all think that the concept of a species is real, you know, the concept of the species of tiger is real, but evolutionary biology says you just have gradations backwards in time and no point where tiger begins and something else starts. So it shouldn't be a problem that this is just a vague notion. So that's the response to the preferred basis problem. I have only a couple of minutes left, so let me move on to the second problem, which is, in my view, sort of the more significant problem that people have talked about. It's the problem with how to deal with probabilities. So the first problem is just, you've got this theory that's presumed to be deterministic, right? No uncertainty about what's going to happen in the future. And it says that it's not like one outcome of measurement occurs. All the outcomes occur. There's some branch of the wave function, every outcome occurs. So there's no objective indeterminism, no what Popper would call propensities, sort of objective probabilities. There's also nothing to be ignorant about, right? It's all deterministic. So where can probabilities possibly enter in the picture for that sort of theory? So imagine the following situation. You've got a whole bunch of these spins all prepared in the up plus down state, and a whole bunch of apparatuses. The first apparatus measures the first spin, becomes entangled with it. The second apparatus measures the second spin, becomes entangled with it. And so all the system apparatus pairs become entangled with one another. And you can just read off all the apparatus what the sequence of outcomes you got was. And so there'll be a term in the wave function where all the apparatuses write out the plus outcome, and there's another term where the first outcome was minus and the other three were plus, and so on. So you get this branching structure for any sequence of measurements like that. Okay, so what are we going to say about this sort of pattern? So first of all, you know, all these branches are considered to be equally actual. It is not the case that one of them is what occurs and the others were merely possible. You have anyone want to say, no, there's a person out there in a parallel world that experiences every one of these possibilities. So you can't really say that, you know, that what we normally call the probability of observing, you know, this particular sequence is the probability somehow that the like real version of me ends up in that branch. Because the everyday wants to say, no, all of those branches there are perfectly valid versions of you, and there's no special one that corresponds to the real you. There's no sense in which you can pick out one of those to define probabilities. Okay, so there's a standard sort of approach here, which is, I think, a kind of false start on solving this problem, which appeals to counting. So you might say, well, we're going to have to interpret the probability somehow as relative frequencies of certain kinds of patterns versus certain other kinds of patterns. And so the first problem with that is that if you just take a counting measure, then what you're going to find is in the limit that the number of experiments goes to infinity, the most typical pattern is the one that has half plus and half minus in it. Right? That's the lion's share of all the patterns, just by the law of large numbers. So if you just use a counting measure, you would say, okay, the relative frequency of the plus outcome is a half. And that's true regardless of what A and B were. Right? If I just count up branches, regardless of the values of A and B, it'll always come back, yeah, you expect that for most of these branches, you'll see plus half the time. So somehow, that can't be right either. What you need to do to recover the quantum probabilistic statements is say, no, I have to weight these different branches by the Born measure to recover A squared as the probability of plus. But then, you know, in what sense is one, you know, like, how do I justify that? How do I justify saying that probabilistic claims have something to do with the amplitude of the branch? The amplitude of the branch doesn't specify anything about the cardinality of the number of branches. It's just this factor that sits in front of the branch. So it's unclear how you can make any sort of counting argument work. And furthermore, and I think maybe this is really the most important point, the whole idea of saying we will interpret probabilities in terms of relative frequencies. So the idea here is that we're going to define what it means to have a certain probability in terms of properties of relative frequencies of outcomes in these branches. That whole approach has really relied heavily on the law of large numbers. The idea that, look, in the limit that n goes to infinity, I can say that certain sorts of frequencies of occurrences become typical. So there are many papers written that try to do this, and they all rely on the law of large numbers. And the problem is that if you look at the law of large numbers, what it says is that in the limit that n goes to infinity, the relative frequency of pluses is highly likely to go to a half. Right? So that the probability that the relative frequency of pluses is a half goes to one. So it's got that concept of probability right in there. So you can't define probability in terms of relative frequencies, because the law of large numbers already uses the concept of probability to make sense of the notion that the relative frequencies tend to a particular value. So you just, this whole sort of approach, I think, is not conceptually well-founded, because you can't really appeal to the law of large numbers to define probability. Okay, so let me finish up. There's a better approach, which is called the decision theoretic approach. So David Deutsch was the one who first proposed this. And so even classically, there's an approach to understanding probabilities in terms of decision theory. So the scenario here is that, you know, you're offered a number of different bets, and you assign a utility, like a dollar value to these various things. And you can work out, you can make arguments that say some features of probability theory can be derived from just maximizing the utility of an agent in those circumstances. So you have to assume certain things, like if an agent prefers A to B and they prefer B to C, then they should prefer A to C. So as long as you have certain minimal constraints on people's utilities, you can derive certain features of probability theory. So Deutsch wants to use that kind of strategy in the Everett context to show that if a particular branch has Born rule weight P, then an observer in this universe who cares about future versions of themselves should act, you know, take bets and things like that, just as they would act in a classical, in an indeterministic world if they assign probability P to that outcome. So that's essentially what Deutsch is trying to argue. I won't go into any more depth into his arguments, but there have been some responses. So in particular, this paper by Barnum et al. Criticizes Deutsch's proof and says that ultimately, if you look at the proof carefully, you'll find that there's some set of equal amplitude options which Deutsch essentially assumes should be assigned, the agent should be indifferent to those options. So they argue that you're already equating amplitudes with probabilities at that step of the proof. So you're not deriving the fact that amplitudes should be associated with probabilities. You've already assumed it in the step. So sorry that I can't go into more depth, but I'm trying to give you just a flavor for the back and forth. I've gone over time, I'm sorry. Let me take one more minute to just specify a few other criticisms of Everett, and then I'll stop. So one thing that Deutsch has said about Everett, and I mentioned in one of the lectures, was that it was by thinking about Everett that he came up with the idea of a quantum computer. So you might say, that's good, that's a point in favor of the Everett interpretation. But in response to that, people have noted that the intuition that Deutsch talks about, which is that the intuition for quantum computers being more powerful than classical computers is that you've got computations happening in parallel worlds. And the criticism is that if the computation really were happening in parallel worlds, you'd expect the computational complexity of quantum computers to be much stronger than what they actually are. They'd be able to solve much harder problems. So the intuition behind quantum computers is sort of faulty, the criticism goes. That it doesn't explain the precise power of quantum computers. It over-explains. And there's something similar if I take alternatives to quantum theory that you'll hear about from Lucien next week, I expect. You know, for example, alternatives that involve stronger violations of Bell inequalities. You can come up with a many worlds interpretation of them as well. And so the many worlds interpretation also seems like a quite generic interpretational move that doesn't fit quantum theory perfectly. You can almost make it work for any theory. So that's what I've summarized here. By the way, all these slides are now available online, so if I rush through them, you can still read about it later. And then finally, this is my own personal objection to Everett, and I'll end here, which is that, okay, so there's this story by Borges called The Library of Babel, and it imagines a library that contain all possible books. So he describes sort of what a book is. It has so many pages, so many letters per line, so many lines per page. And he says, let's think about what this library looks like. And it's exponentially large, right? Because, you know, at every position, you know, you have this these possibilities. And if you think about how big this library is, you know, Dennett, for example, said, look, you could spend your whole life in a spaceship traveling through the library, and you would never get out of a section that superficially just looks like minor variations of Moby Dick, and you can't even tell. So it's this huge space, and the size of that space suggests that what we're talking about here is a set of possibilities, not a set of actualities. And the wave function is like that. There's if you look at the parameters in the wave function, there's an exponentially large number of wave functions, which suggests we shouldn't be thinking of these different branches of the wave function, like, you know, that sequence of Stern-Gerlach experiments, the number of branches increases exponentially. That exponential scaling is characteristic of spaces of possibilities, not characteristic of spaces of actual things. And so there, to my mind, exponential scaling kind of tells you, think of me as a set of possibilities, don't think of me as a set of realities. And Everett is trying to say, no, they're all real. And that seems, to me, strange. So, hey, I'll end there. I apologize for going over.